You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with my dear good friend, Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett, raconteur, Rod Bennett, author, essayist,
star of multiple stage, screen, and television.
Well, yes, multiple time guest on the Journey Home, and yes, and All around swell guy and Wednesday co-host on Connecting the Dots. How you doing, man?
I'm doing real good. Happy to be back on the program. You guys haven't turned me out yet, so here I am.
We're here to provide a place for you every Wednesday evening at 5 p.m. your time.
That's, no matter how many listeners it runs off.
There's always a place for you here, and
Thank you for saying so. That's good to know in these end times.
These troubled times. I'm sitting here right now looking out my wall. You may be wondering how I'm able to do that. So my wife, who does these odd things now and then, she'll go out and do these weird little things. Years ago, when I was working on By What Authority, I was sitting there at my computer, minding my own business, typing away. And she came into the room where I was sitting, which was going to be the baby's room for our son, Peter, who is now 21. So that tells you how long ago this was. And she stood there with her hands on her hips, looking at our blank wall, studying it for a long time, and then she went away, and she came back with a paint set and proceeded to paint an entire wall mural. Just because.
The spirit moved.
Yes, it was just, I wasn't expecting that, you know? And that's the nice thing about being a homeowner, is you could do that. You could just say, you know what this wall needs? A mural. and the landlord won't get mad at you. So, So anyway, I walked out of the bedroom the other day, and there on the kitchen floor, she had, you can go out and buy like these scenes. They're like a sort of a Wile E. Coyote hole in the wall thing that you could just lay down or stick on the wall or lay on the floor. And it will be like a scene into another world. And so it was like this seascape with pteranodons.
That
suddenly
sounds cool.
This portal opened up in our kitchen floor. And so now there's a seascape with pteranodons. And then I was sitting here the other day and she said, I hope you don't get cold from that breeze coming through the wall. And I said, what? And I turned around and this is how unobservant I am. She had put up this, another one of these things, and it's like this view out into Rivendell.
With the
slanting golden autumnal sunlight,
yeah.
and everything. And I was like, I just never know what to expect from you. So these things are now happening in our house, and we have two portals. And I suspect I'll be minding my own business, and suddenly another portal will open somewhere in our house to some other realm. So that's what we're
got them in a package deal.
Yeah, I don't know. She just goes out and does these things, so it's marvelous and just one of the joys of being married to
happy homeowner too. Yeah, that's great.
So what's happening today? Well, I see that Trump has just now announced that he does want to reinstate torture. So because we have to fight fire with fire, he says, when it comes to stopping terrorism, which means that we need to become terrorists.
We need to start doing the same kind of stuff that ISIS does, right? That's obviously the problem.
That's the problem, is we're not evil enough. And so our new president is all about bringing back torture because he believes it works.
In so many words, we're well past finessing waterboarding, or whether waterboarding or something is torture. This is straight up the T word.
Yep. He doesn't even bother calling it enhanced interrogation.
Right.
So
right.
Now the way this worked in the past with Catholic apologetics for torture was you first of all said, show me that it's wrong. And then when you would appeal to the appropriate church documents and say, this is where the church says it's intrinsically immoral, just like abortion, and therefore, and gravely and intrinsically immoral, and therefore it can never be done under any circumstances, then the trick was to begin the euphemism game. Well, it's not torture, it's enhanced interrogation, you see, and that's totally, totally different.
Right.
And then you spend a lot of time playing word games and trying to pretend that what is torture is not actually torture. And that really worked for a long time because the Bush administration always called it enhanced interrogation, which was a term that they borrowed from the Gestapo, which meant torture. But as long as you call it something else, then it's not torture, and so you can do it. Well, the problem is that Trump calls it torture. And so you can't play that game anymore. So it'd be interesting to see the strategies that are trotted out by Catholic Trump supporters to rationalize their support for mortal sin.
Just to remove any doubt, he explicitly said waterboarding and a hell of a lot worse.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's all bad.
Any doubt about what's on his mind, there's no need to spend any additional time on it whatsoever.
Yep. So that's all coming back. And the impressive thing will be to watch then the moral pretzels into which Christian torture supporters. Now, Protestants, of course, don't have respect for the magisterium, so that won't be an issue for them. They'll just say, well, I like it. And here's my Bible verse that says it's okay, so that's fine. But it'll be fascinating to watch and see what Catholics do. There are Catholics who have a consistent life ethic who will stand against it. I know that they'll stand against it because they stood against it when the Bush administration was doing it. But they were the minority. And so this is going to be interesting to watch this rationalization game, which reminds me, you wanted to talk about presidents today. We've got a new administration. There have been a number of presidents before this one, I'm told. I remember something about.
Yes. Some folks
I'm not
may
sure
remember
how long
that back during the primary season, we did you and I did a program about, it was the day after that Trump won the nomination. And so we did a kind of a program where we sort of commiserated over that and maybe offered a word or two of encouragement to people who felt as unhappy about it as we did. Mm-hmm. Now that the man's actually taken office, I thought there might be some postmortem to do, but also I think I may have one or two ideas that may be a little encouraging, that may get us off the carpet just a little bit.
And, I'm ready.
Not of course minimizing any of the gravity of what's going on.
Right. I'm all in favor of encouragement. I could use some of my own self.
good.
I just wrote a little piece for Catholic Weekly out in Sydney, Australia. I do a weekly piece for them, and I decided I would kind of sit down and try to hash out a little bit of my thoughts on the Christian's relationship to the state and so forth, and particularly taking a look at Romans 13. That's kind of the New Testament treatise, if you will, on the Christian's relationship to the state is Romans 13. There are other kind of offhanded remarks it really kind of, it all, if you want to find it in a nutshell, it's Jesus's remark, you know, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar, and Caesar's and unto God that which is God's. And Romans 13 sort of dilates that on that a little bit. And you could see it kind of in practice with the apostles. Wherever they can, they cooperate with the state. And when the state asks them to do something they just can't cooperate with, then they say, we must obey God rather than men.
Right.
And then, you know, here come the consequences after that. And that's kind of what you get in the New Testament.
Pray for the emperor. Some other
pray for
like
the
that.
Honor the king, pay your taxes, obey the law. It's kind of, that's it, you know. And if that's not good enough for Caesar, and if he starts demanding that you do things that are against church teaching and against your conscience, then you say no and you bide the consequences.
Right.
And
you're offered opportunity to bear witness. A word which in Greek means martyr.
Yes.
The Greek word for bearing witness means you got an opportunity to bear witness with your blood.
Yeah. And so in the early church, that's in the New Testament church, that's kind of what you're looking at. Later on, when the empire becomes a Christian empire, then all of a sudden the church is in a position, which we're going to have to talk about in a minute when we get back from our break. The church is suddenly in a position where it's never been before, which is with a state that might actually assist in people finding it easier to be virtuous and be Christians. And what do you do then? We'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're talking today with Mr. Rod Bennett about the new administration and our duty as Catholic Christians. And we'll be right back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've been talking a little bit, sort of as prelude to our discussion of the presidents. What you get in the New Testament is it really summarized by Jesus's very pithy, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's. So Christianity has always had a regard for the rights of the state, that the state has a real place in the economy of God, that Caesar, even when he's Nero, is preferable to anarchy. And so Paul says, obey the law, pay your taxes, and honor the king. Because those are the things that Caesar actually deserves. What's interesting is that none of that is couched in the language of love. It's all the language of duty. So this is kind of bare minimum requirements. Paul has no interest in the glory of the state. He's not interested in national glory for Israel. He's not interested in national glory for Rome. What he's interested in is, in what he's talking about, when Paul's writing about the state, he's writing about the Roman state. And he's saying this.
Of which he was a citizen.
Which he was a citizen. And he says, you're supposed to, and you owe it to your civic leaders to pray for them as well, says Paul. And the reason you do that, says Paul, what he's writing to Timothy, is so that we can live quiet lives and do our thing as Christians. And that's really, that's why the state
here. So that we can travel under the radar, in other words.
Right. And so the state exists so that we'll have nice roads, so that we can get from place to place, so that
basic law and order is kept.
Yeah, it will not. There will not be mayhem going on all the time.
Right.
You can travel the length and breadth of the Roman Empire, and you won't get assaulted by bandits. And that.
Yeah,
kind
in
of
another
thing.
Passage, he says the state does not bear the sword in vain. In other
right.
words, he recognizes that a good portion of what every state does is perfectly valid, punishing
right.
murderers and thieves and all the rest of it, and maintaining basic law and order.
Basic law and order. And so that's his relationship to the state. And he doesn't, and nobody in the early church thought of themselves as, you know, sort of cheerleaders for the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So the early Christians were pacifists, for example. Why? Well, who wants to belong to a pagan army whose one of whose principal jobs is killing us? Right?
Yeah. At this
and
point,
so,
yeah.
Right. And so, you know, why would it would be like, you know, Jews aspiring to join the Wehrmacht? Why would we want to do that? You know, all they want to do is kill us. So we'll just stay out of their way. And it's not until the empire becomes Christian that the church is suddenly confronted with something that had never obtained for it before, which was the possibility that you might actually have a state apparatus that could make it easier for us to practice virtue as Christians. What then? Do we foster such a state? Are we invested in a state like that?
It actually runs deeper than that. It becomes the problem of what if your evangelism is so successful that pretty much everybody becomes a Christian?
Right. Well, nominally.
At this point, don't the lines between secular government and church discipline get pretty blurry? Especially if we're all members of one church.
Exactly.
This was the thing. I mention it in my book, The Apostasy That Wasn't, but one of the things that makes the problem of Constantine difficult to understand is that Constantine, before his conversion, had the title of Pontifex Maximus. It was an established role in the Roman Empire. The Pontifex Maximus, the chief bridge builder, his main job was to be in charge of religion. Well, not his main job. One of his jobs under that title was to be the head of religion in the Roman Empire, the head of, in some ways, all the cults.
Right.
And so the question he faced was, okay, what happens now that I'm a Christian? In other words, I used to be the Pope, so to speak.
Right.
And now I'm under the Pope, or under the church authorities, the bishops, including the Pope.
Yeah.
So, you know, am I Caesar, or am I just a layman, you know?
Right.
And
right.
it was a difficult problem. The early fathers wrestled over the whole thing. You know, several of the early fathers expressed the idea that probably the Roman Empire would never be Christian, because how could Caesar be converted? Because how could he both simultaneously be somebody's subject and also the head of the state, you know?
Right, right. And the churches, East and West, roughly speaking, resolved this problem in different ways. We are children of the Western Church. Here in the United States and in all of Western Europe, we come out of the Roman Catholic engagement with the state. And that engagement basically said that there is a spiritual authority, the Pope, and there's a secular authority, the prince. And we, here in the United States, we have carried that basic idea to the point where we have an entire constitutional order that's predicated on the idea of separation of church and state. And that goes all the way back to this long duel that went on between the papacy and the prince in what was called the investiture controversy. The question
right.
was, who gets to appoint bishops? Is it the prince or is it the Pope? And the Pope said the Pope does it. And a lot of princes tried to say, well, the prince does it. And in Protestant countries, the prince won.
Yeah.
That's basically what happened in the Reformation, in the English Reformation especially. But in the Eastern, and all of that for the Catholic Church was predicated exactly on the idea that render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and unto God that which is God. So that distinction between the sacred and the secular. Well, in the Eastern Church, what the Eastern Church did was it looked back to Old Testament models. And in the Old Testament, you have in ancient Israel, sure, there's a priestly caste, the Levitical caste, but also what you see, particularly in a Davidic monarchy, was that the king had a kind of quasi-sacral role. And so David, for example, speaks of his heir, the son of David, in priestly terms. And he behaves himself as a priest when he enters on his reign. That's why it's a big deal when he puts on a linen ephod and dances before the Ark of the Covenant.
Right.
That's a priestly act, and the king is doing it.
Right.
And so in the Eastern Church, what tended to happen was the emperor took on this quasi-sacral role. And that gets played out all the way through Eastern Christianity, right up through this idea that the Tsar, for example, in Russia, had this kind of quasi-sacral role. And that idea really goes south when the prince becomes Stalin.
Right.
That's bad, right? And so Stalin,
the lesson is right there in the same books that establish all these things, and that is that almost all of Israel's kings were not just bad, but terrible.
Really terrible people, yeah.
Yeah.
And so you can see how both traditions are trying to work out of a biblical framework.
Right. And it continues to haunt our imagination here because, you know, we've all, part of the national myth is the Pilgrim Fathers and the, religious right. freedom and here to champion all of that. And as a result, the President of the United States has got a sort of, in the minds of many Americans, and traditionally more than have it now, the idea that the presidency right. of the United States is somehow the defender of the faith, he's here to keep this shining city on a hill where everybody's free to worship God according to the light of their own conscience and
right.
attend the church of their choice each and every Sunday. It's his job to keep this maintained. And as a result, the presidency in the United States has tended to acquire some of these sacral trappings, you know.
Right.
And certainly much more, I think, than many of the founders intended. And but it continues to haunt our imagination even now, the idea that this office has some sort of role in God's economy.
Right. And there's nothing new in this, by the way. It really is. It's right in our DNA as Americans, our political DNA. So you get if you go to the Capitol, you can see the apotheosis of George Washington. This is an actual painting.
Right, right.
As George Washington is taken up into heaven, just like Jesus at the Ascension.
Yeah.
And you see this all the way through our history. There was nothing remarkable.
Well, it's interesting. The painting that you're talking about inside the Capitol Dome actually is a lot more pagan than it is Christian. It looks it really looks more like Apollo or Zeus or somebody like that.
Oh yeah,
They're definitely throughout. In other words, a lot of the people who put that up were Unitarians like John Adams and Jefferson and others. In other words, they were sort of doing what Maximilian Robespierre tried to do a few years later, and that was to create of a secular, rational religion of the cult of the supreme being, you know.
Rod, we're up against the break right now, but we'll be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We'll be back with Rod Bennett right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. As we're launching into this new administration, you had some thoughts you wanted to share, and some encouraging.
Well, I sort of encouraged myself in some ways after the election with these thoughts. So let's see if they're at all helpful.
Okay.
I preface this by saying to those who may not have listened to me on this subject in the past, I did not vote for Trump. I did not vote for Mrs. Clinton. I describe myself as an equally bad fit in both parties. Some people read that as the typical pox on both their houses position. It really isn't. In my case, it's more like a blessing on both their houses. In other words, I hope the best for everybody. I hope both parties will follow their better angels and discourage their worst tendencies. And I'm usually disappointed, but in my case, it's a perfectly sincere, not oppose of nonpartisanship, but nonpartisanship is just saying I can't be part of either one of these as they currently exist. So, and they don't fit. It's not some sort of principled stand. I just, it doesn't work. In other words, people say, well, which party would you join if you had to join one? I'd say that it could be a coin toss in my case because both of them need to pretty much be remade from top to bottom. So it might just as well begin in one of the parties as in the other.
Mm-hmm.
But having said all of that, just to head off any potential red herrings in the discussion ahead. I was a never Trumper from the day that his candidacy was announced. The main reason I gave for this was the chief central reason was that if Trump wins, he gets to permanently remake the Republican Party in his own image. In other words, right. A lot of people were willing to say, well, okay, we'll take him for 4 years because he's better than Hillary. You can't do that. The whole thing is designed in such a way that the president gets to begin immediately remaking the party in his image, the party right. of which he's the titular head. So he's got vast powers along these lines, and they have always used them in the past. So my argument was you don't get to just vote for Trump this time. You get vote for a permanently changed Republican Party.
Yeah.
And again, no great allegiance to the Republican Party, but the country is going to have and needs a conservative party.
Mm-hmm.
This being the case, I'm hoping for a sane one rather than an insane one.
Well, you lose.
Well, now here is my point, though. Now here is the deeper thought that encouraged me a little. A lot of us are terrified by the idea of this guy with his hand on the red button, you know, the nuke codes and all the rest of it. And the idea of him being a completely bananas loose cannon is, I think, a little bit of a bogey in the night, and I'll tell you why I think that's the case.
Okay.
I'm going to say something historically that I hope many people might read as a conspiracy theory. It isn't. It's just a fact about the presidency, and that fact is that throughout our history, even with some of our best presidents, the nature of the presidency is that of a paid spokesmodel for a larger organization.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, in every case, whether it be Abraham Lincoln, whoever you want to pick, the man who is chosen to represent the corporation is somebody who has been handpicked to give a certain signal, to give out a certain vibe, so to speak. And he's somebody that is the face of a larger machine. And what this means is that in reality, there's always a man behind the curtain. There's always the president is sometimes an unwitting, but usually a conscious, not a tool, but an agent of usually subtler, deeper men. and that he has been picked, you know, to be the face of the thing and to put his name on the documents. But he, I mean, another way to say it so that it doesn't sound so conspiracy-like is that every president has his advisors. No man could possibly know what the right decision on all the hundreds of things that he has to do every day is. So he goes to other people. He's got his experts, his advisors, whatever. So if you'd like, if you'd prefer to say it that way, rather than a man behind the curtain, there are people who tell him what decision is the right one. Not that he never has opinions of his own.
Yeah.
Okay. As an example, Andrew Jackson's man behind the curtain was Martin Van Buren, who later became president himself. Van Buren picked Jackson, who up to this point had sworn that he wouldn't be a good president, picked him as the party's candidate for the upcoming election. He and Van Buren was a Democratic Party boss, okay? A few years later, throughout the post-Civil War era, the later 1800s, the Republicans, the head of the Republicans, the boss, was a guy named Mark Hanna. So they've always been here, and they always have been. Mm-hmm. So part what I'm getting at is that part of the scary myth of Donald Trump is that he's this crazy guy who just decided he'd like to be president, and it happened. And now his every whim will be law, and you know he's this nutty guy who's in over his head. However much truth that may have in it, I think he's the tool of deeper and subtler men, as I was saying earlier. Mm-hmm. Now I have my guesses about who the head of these deeper and subtler men are is, but we can go into that if you want to. But I think that these men, career Washington types, are the guys who, I won't see if I say really pulling the strings, that makes it sound more conspiracy-like than I mean it, but simply he's not loose to do whatever he likes. He owes his position to more powerful people that are not in the spotlight, and those people can take back what they've given. And he knows it. And this has always been the case throughout our history.
Okay.
So in a way, that's comforting. Because whoever these guys are and whatever it is they want to achieve, it's not going to take the form of a loony guy who might just press the button when he has a bad day, you know.
Well, I'm going to push back against that some.
Sure, go ahead.
Let me preface this by saying I am not saying these two people are equivalent. Okay.
All right.
I want to make that very clear because I'm really sick of Hitler comparisons all the time. But having said that, the reality is exactly that was said about the people who bankrolled Hitler. They will control him. And, you know, he's beholden to these moneyed interests and they'll be able to ride herd on him and he won't get out of control. Sure, he's got some crazy ideas, but it's not going to go anywhere because the guys that are bankrolling him will.
That's not really what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, I think that Hitler had powerful people behind him who wanted to do what he did.
Well, I'm not so sure about that.
At least some of his supporters wanted him to do exactly what he did.
Well,
you're talking about people who, other conservatives, less radical conservatives. That's maybe I should go ahead and give the rest of what I'm driving at.
Go ahead.
I think the man behind the curtain is Dick Cheney.
Okay.
Which shouldn't be too surprising because Dick Cheney was the man behind the curtain all through the W. Bush years.
Okay.
And that's well established. Again, not a conspiracy theory. Bush was chosen to run because they were having a hard time coming up with anybody. And he was a youngish guy who gave off a confident vibe. And he happened to be the president's son, which somehow made him stand out from amongst the other governors as not just another politician.
Okay.
So they picked him to be the face of the corporation for a while.
Okay.
The difference here is that there was a schism between Dick Cheney and the Bushes part of the way through W's term.
Okay.
The elder Bush, in fact, in his autobiography, says, you know, I like and appreciate Dick Cheney, but he became too much of a hardliner.
Mm-hmm.
And this is borne out by the fact that all of the other Republican former presidents not only did not back Trump, they actively, they sent Mitt Romney out to badmouth him for half an hour on TV.
Right.
Except for Dick Cheney.
Okay.
Remember, Dick Cheney, one of the things that caused the break with the elder Bush was the torture issue.
Yeah.
And all of this is to say that Trump is the manifestation of a schism in the Republican Party that had been brewing for some time before this.
Okay.
In other words, we saw it in 2012 when
I hope that they're going to right hurt on it. Oh, you know what? We're up against a break again, Rod. We got it.
Go ahead.
Okay. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we will be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett talking about the,
Go ahead and call it a debacle, Mark. That's okay.
The new reign of the our dear leader elect, who is here to save us all from Muslims and Mexicans and all the rest of it. And so I'm sorry, you were saying before the break.
Well, I want to take just a moment to make sure I'm not misunderstood. You're absolutely right that a lot of traditional German conservatives in the 30s were snookered into giving their support for Adolf Hitler because they believed that more sensible people were on his side and in his party and that they would prevail. That's not really what I'm driving at here. That's really what people who voted for Trump hesitantly have done. Mm-hmm. They're guessing that he won't turn out as bad as it seems like he will turn out.
Right.
My point here is that there is a schism or a division within the Republican Party that we can trace back to the beginnings of this whole Tea Party thing up through especially the 2012 election campaign, where those people were, I mean, you could see the Trump thing coming in 2012 when Mitt Romney was successfully forced down these people's throats after 8 months of one Tea Party type candidate after another flaming out. They were absolutely furious, and you knew that something weird was coming, and of course it did. But my point here is that there has been a schism ever since the days when Dick Cheney broke from the Bushes. I know a lot of people use Dick Cheney as a boogeyman, okay? Mm-hmm. And it is true that some of the stuff that's said about him on the left is nutty. But I will say this, he's absolutely on record as being in favor of what is objectively a fascist understanding of government. Mm-hmm. I understand that word fascist is loaded. It suggests trappings, swastikas, and goose-stepping and all the rest of it. That's not really what I'm getting at. What I mean here by fascist is somebody who believes that that we know what to do, we know what's right, we just need to do it. It's so too important to allow a lot of voting and waffling. We just need to give somebody power to do what's right.
Right.
Okay? The and so that's the essential idea of it. And Dick Cheney has said many times that he believes that the President of the United States, well, essentially, he believes what Richard Nixon believed about the presidency, and that is that if it's not illegal if the president does it.
Right.
He believes that in a crisis, the president has whatever powers he needs to save the country. In other words, there's nothing more important than saving the country, so legal niceties have to go out the window when the United States is in an existential crisis. The trouble with fascism is that it's always in an existential crisis.
Right.
You can always make people believe, including yourself, that the country will fail if we don't do what we need to do right now. So we take out the extraordinary powers we need, and we go with them.
Right.
And I think that Trump, whom I've always said was a proto-fascist in the making, even though you're absolutely right, he's one of the reasons the Hitler parallel doesn't work is because Hitler was a much more intelligent and less amateurish person. He carefully schooled a party and built an organization for years. Trump hasn't done anything like that.
I do think... He was the man with a huge single theory. You know, I mean, he believed all this crap about, you know, racial superiority, you know, and he had this whole scheme worked out about how we needed to, you know, gas the inferiors and so forth. And, you know,
Trump's just a grouchy old guy who's mad. Foreigners.
Trump is certainly a racist, but he doesn't have this grand theory of.
Right.
That's
the sense, in a weird sense in which it dignifies him to compare him to Hitler.
Yeah. He's just, you know, he wants to get rich, and if he can, you know, he'll happily kick around anybody who's brown in order to, you know, have a scapegoat. He's the sort of guy who, you know, will change whatever he says, you know, tomorrow.
Well, it's absolutely true that a lot of this stuff that he said about build a wall and make Mexico, all that comes from Steve Bannon, who was his advisor long before Trump made it official.
Right.
Steve Bannon is the guy who came to Donald Trump and said, look, there are a lot of disaffected people out here, the so-called Reagan Democrats who came into the Republican Party when they got excommunicated from the Democrats for being segregationists, et cetera. Those people are still out there. They haven't died. They haven't become extinct. They just don't vote very often anymore because they hate people like Mitt Romney.
Right.
If you say these five things, Mr. Trump, and again, this is Steve Bannon talking, I guarantee you, you'll be the next president of the United States.
Yeah.
Build a wall, make Mexico pay for it, Hillary for prison, Muslim registry and all, deport all the Muslims. What else? There are several other things on the list. Say these things whether you believe them or not.
Drain the swamp, yeah.
Yes, say them whether you believe them or not, because you can forget all about it after you're president, and I guarantee you'll be elected.
Did you see
that much is real if you read about Bannon's influence on the election? Okay.
Rod, did you see the speech when he was doing the victory lap tour? He gave a speech. This is in front of this gigantic stadium full of people. He's giving this speech and he's going, you know, when they first came to me and they told me, you know, they said you should say drain the swamp. And he says to this crowd of people, he says, I thought that was so hokey. But I thought, I'll try it. He's telling this to literally thousands and thousands of his followers. He's saying, I thought Drain the Swamp was so hokey, but I'll try it. So I said, Drain the Swamp. Everybody went nuts. And this was the line that really got me. He goes, so then I said, I'll try saying it like I mean it.
this Drain is the kind of thing that Hitler did not.
Yeah, right. It was like, are you listening to this? You know?
He comes out and laughs about lying to his supporters and all the rest of it.
You're all like, yeah, you lied. Way to go. You won. And that's it. It's just they don't care, you know?
Well, when I say that there's some encouragement in the idea that deeper subtler men are behind the scenes. I don't mean that these deeper, subtler men are not dark in their own way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think they are very dark.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, George H.W. Bush himself, George the First, split with Dick Cheney over these kinds of issues, began to call him a hardliner.
Yeah.
And that word hardliner means a lot to George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush the First, because hardliners during his administration were the people that tried to put Gorbachev down, you know, in the Soviet Union. So it's a serious split. And it was an ominous moment during the campaign when all of the previous Republican presidents repudiated Trump. Even sent Mitt Romney out to badmouth him on television for half an hour.
Yep.
And Dick Cheney supported him.
Yep. And lost.
So, and a few other important people who broke.
And the majority of pro-life Catholic Christians.
Right.
Are backing him too. And that is what breaks my heart.
Absolutely. Because he's just the walking stereotype of what pro-choicers think pro-life is all about.
Right. Yeah.
They don't take seriously the idea of the life of the unborn or any of that stuff. They think it's about suppressing women. It's boorish, chauvinistic men imposing their ways on women. Well, I mean, we've got a real model of a boorish, chauvinistic man sitting in Washington's seat right now. So it's just a confirmation to them that that's what pro-life was about all along.
Yep. And you know, and how should you put it? When you're doing the things that they say that you're doing the things that they say that you're doing.
Right.
And it's no longer, you know, well, it's not really like that. You know, now we're forced to confront the fact that, yeah, actually for a lot of pro-life people, it really is like that. You know, they do, in fact, say you can go ahead and be a sex predator. And we support that. You know, wow, we're supporting it for a greater good. Yeah, see, there's a whole Catholic moral thing that says you can't do that. Well, who cares what the church says? You know, well, then why are you bothering to call yourself Catholic? You know, that's the weird thing is listening to people telling. Yeah, I was talking to somebody today and I was saying, you know, what if we just support the whole of Catholic teaching?
Yeah, novel idea.
What if we just do that? What if we just go ahead and be against abortion, but also, you know, when the church says no to the death penalty, just agree to that? That's utopian, I was told. Well, now, wait a second. So it's not utopian to believe that Donald Trump is going to magic abortion out of existence. That's sober realism. But saying we should listen to the whole teaching of the church, that's utopian.
Right.
Is that
what
you're telling me? You know, and as a matter of fact, that is, you know.
Well, he's not going to do that. But in some ways, I will say this, in a nutshell, my encouraging idea was it may not be any worse than the W. Bush era, depending on how things go, because I think the same guy's in charge again.
Well,
okay. But it might be.
I have
right now, it looks like the country's having trouble swallowing Trump in a way that they haven't had trouble in the past.
Yeah, well, you know, they're a sharp learning curve ahead. We are, unfortunately, out of time, Rod, but I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. My co-host today was Rod Bennett. Our producer was Danny Head. And we will be back tomorrow with Mr. Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.